Yes, Leia agreed, frowning. Odd. Despite the hopeless mismatch in size and firepower, the skiffs were nevertheless holding their ground. And suddenly she saw why. Coming up fast on the skiff's far side were a pair of Diamalan blockade carriers.
Elago saw them, too. I believe, he said, someone has decided to force the issue.
Leia glanced across the rest of the gathered ships. Others were starting to react to the imminent confrontation, starting to drift out of their confining orbital slots, or opening fighter bay doors, or rotating so as to better target the nearest of the opposition. The Sifkri skiffs were starting to waver now, clearly not eager to be at the center of a massive firefight. The Ashori, recognizing their hesitation, increased its speed toward them. In response, the two Diamala also picked up their pace, splitting formation into a flanked crossfire stance.
They are going to run down those Sifkris, Elagos murmured, or else the Diamala will open fire on the Ashori to prevent it. Either way, both sides will claim the other was the instigator.
And either way, the shooting starts, Leia said tightly, running her fingers down the sensor data. New Republic ships. There had to be some New Republic ships out there somewhere. If one of them was close enough to intervene, or even get in between the Ashori and Diamala. But there were only three Corellian corvettes carrying New Republic IDs, all on the far side of the pack of ships. No chance at all that they could get to the confrontation in time. Which meant it was up to her. Everyone hang on! She called toward the intercom. Without waiting for a reply from the two Nogri, she turned the Falcon's nose toward the Ashori cruiser and threw full power to the sublight drive. The engines roared to life, the acceleration pushing Leia momentarily into her seat before the compensators could catch up.
I trust you have a plan, Elago said calmly over the noise. Do bear in mind that your High Council authority will not likely be enough to stop them.
I wasn't even going to bring that up, Leia said, glancing at the nav display and easing the helm yoke back just a bit. The Falcon was now on a collision course with the Ashori cruiser's stern. Takeover, she added, pulling off her restraints and snagging her lightsaber as she got up from her seat. Keep us on this course!
Understood.
Elagos' voice came distantly back to her as she sprinted down the tunnel and skidded past the exit hatchway toward the aft cargo bay bulkhead door. She stretched out to the control switch with the Force as she approached, sending the door sliding open.
Counselor?
Mark Kim's anxious voice called from the upper quad laser. Stay there! Leia called to him as she ducked into the cargo bay and crossed to the starboard side of the ship. Through one more door, and she came at last to the access grille protecting the starboard power converters and ion flux stabilizer. Han was going to kill her. But it was their only chance. Igniting her lightsaber, clenching her teeth, she jabbed the glowing blade into one of the power converters and dragged it across into the stabilizer. And grabbed for a handhold as the Falcon bucked like a stung tauntaun. It bucked again, and suddenly the drone of the engines changed to an ominous whine. 20 seconds later, she was back in the cockpit. Report? She asked, as she slid back into her seat.
We've lost starboard maneuvering, Elico said. The engines appear to be trying to go into a feedback instability.
He glanced at her.
I certainly hope this is part of your plan.
Trust me, Leia assured him, trying to feel as confident as she sounded as she keyed the comm. Ishori Cruiser, this is Freighter Millennium Falcon. We're in serious trouble and urgently request assistance. There was no answer. Ishori Cruiser!
This is the Ishori War Cruiser, Pratamanins!
An angry-sounding Ishori voice snarled from the speaker.
Identify yourself!
This is New Republic High Counselor Leia Organa Solo, aboard the freighter Millennium Falcon, Leia said. We've lost maneuvering and power control in our starboard engines. Our current course has us passing too close to your hull. I need you to move immediately out of our path while we try to regain control. There was another long pause. Leia watched the warship looming ever nearer, uncomfortably aware that if the Ishori commander chose, he could easily turn this whole thing to his own advantage. He had only to use her request as an excuse to speed up his drive toward the Sifkri skiffs.
I ask you to please hurry,
Leia said. A thought occurred to her, and she reached over to blur the fine focus of her comm a bit, just enough to let some of the other ships beyond the Ishori eavesdrop on the transmission.
My passenger, Trustant Elagos Akla, is attempting to effect repairs, but I'm afraid the equipment aboard is not within standard Ka'amasi technical expertise.
Without a word, Elagos unstrapped and got to his feet, disappearing out through the cockpit door.
Ishori cruiser predominance. Do you still copy?
Leia added.
Repeating.
No need to repeat.
The voice snarled again. Leia felt automatic anger stirring in response to the tone, forced herself to remember that all the emotion in the Ishori voice meant there was some serious thinking going on. She shifted her eyes to the cruiser again and held her breath. And abruptly, the Ishori's advance toward the skiff slowed, its stern rotating instead out of the Falcon's path.
We stand ready to assist you and Trustant Akla,
the Ishori bit out. His voice already sounded calmer. The thinking was over, and it was time for action.
Lower your shields and prepare for acceleration impact,
he continued.
We will attempt to lock a tractor beam onto you to slow your rush.
Thank you,
Leia said, keying off the shields. They didn't affect tractor beams all that much, but there was no point in making a tricky high-speed grab any harder than it already was.
Once we're in your beam, we'll try a cold shutdown and see if we can bring this under control.
We stand ready to provide any assistance you and Trustant Akla require. Stand ready.
The Falcon jerked as the tractor beam caught it, wobbled a moment, then settled down as the lock firmed. Reaching across to the engine controls, Leia threw the shutdown switches. The engine whine ran down the scale and faded into silence. On the control board, indicators turned red. Around her, the lights flickered once as battery power took over.
We read successful shutdown. If you wish, we will bring you aboard our ship to assist you in your repairs.
For a moment, Leia was tempted. Having a Ka'amasi aboard one of the most outspoken and confrontational species ships might help stretch the peace out here. But on the other hand, it could also be misinterpreted as Elagos's tacit endorsement of the Ishori's anti-Bothan stance.
Thank you again, she told the alien. But we have an urgent appointment with President Gavrasim that we can't delay. If you would escort us over to the group of New Republic ships, we would very much appreciate it.
Of course,
the Ishori said, with only the barest hesitation. The Diamala had reached the Sifkri skiffs now, the four of them standing together in quiet defiance against any further action. The chance had been missed, and the Ishori knew it. As did the rest of the armada. All around them, Leia saw the other ships were starting to settle back into their taut, watchful waiting. The flashpoint was safely passed. Or at least this flashpoint was. She keyed off the comm.
You're really taking a beating this trip, aren't you?
She murmured, patting the Falcon's control board sympathetically.
I'm sorry.
The door behind her slid open.
I see it worked, Elagos said, slipping into the co-pilot seat again. You have a fine and unique gift of diplomacy, Counselor.
And sometimes I'm just lucky, Leia said.
Elagos lifted his eyebrows.
I thought Jedi didn't believe in luck.
It comes of hanging around Han and his ship, Leia said dryly. Where did you go, anyway? Back to look at the stabilizer?
The Ka'amasi nodded.
I didn't expect to be able to do anything. Certainly not after you'd finished with it. But you'd indicated I was trying to repair it, and I wanted there to be some truth in what you are saying.
Truth,
Leia sighed.
That's what we need here, Elagos. What we need desperately. Truth.
Captain Solo will have that truth here within another day, Elagos reminded her quietly. All you and President Karasam need to do is hold things together that long.
Leia stretched out with the Force, trying to get a feel for the future. No, I don't think so, she said slowly. Something tells me it's not going to be that easy. Not nearly that easy.
Navid and Cliff had cut through the floor of the Hodin Tapcap storage sub-basement floor their first night of work, a 10-minute task with the fusion cutter Penson had scrounged from somewhere. But after that, the job had switched over to something longer, harder, and considerably more tedious.
Four more days of this, huh?
Cliff grunted, heaving another shovelful of noxious boffawee dirt out of the chest-deep hole onto the large drop cloth they'd spread out to catch it.
Well, if we really put our backs into it, maybe it'll only take three,
Navit pointed out, scooping up the dirt from the cloth in turn and dumping it into their Valcrex fusion disintegration canister. He sympathized with Cliff's frustration, but there wasn't a lot either of them could do about it. The vibrations of their digging were iffy enough, but if they tried operating heavy equipment within range of the power conduit sensors, they'd bring Bothan security down on them in double-quick time.
Thanks, Lutz,
Cliff said dryly, dumping another shovelful.
You know, I don't mind dying for the Empire, but to Vader with these preliminaries.
Watch your words,
Navit warned him, glancing at the door at the top of the stairway. Penson was supposed to be keeping an eye on the door to the sub-basement, but there were a handful of other staff and night guards still up in the tapcaf, and a wrong word overheard by one of them could ruin everything. He scooped up the next shovelful. There was a scrabbling sound at the door. Navit let the shovel down silently onto the cloth, dropping to one knee and drawing his blaster in a single smooth motion. He leveled the weapon on the door, then lifted it at the soft 212 knock. The door opened, and Horvick stuck his head around the corner.
Pack it up, he hissed. The night guards think they've spotted an intruder, and they might come down here looking.
Cliff was already out of the hole, manhandling the square of Duracrete floor they'd cut back into place.
They get a good look?
Navit asked, holstering his blaster and giving Cliff a hand.
I don't know, Horvick said grimly. But personally, my money's on that old woman of yours. I spotted someone with your description of her sitting off in a corner booth when Penson and I came on duty.
Terrific,
Navit snarled under his breath, leaving Cliff to disguise the edges of their trapdoor as he shut off the disintegrator and carried it back to its hiding place behind a stack of Vodacrine cases.
Well, don't just stand there. Go help them find her.
Rat, Horvick said. What about you?
We'll head outside, he said. Maybe we can tag her on our way out.
Happy hunting, Horvick said, and disappeared.
It took 30 seconds to fold up the drop cloth and hide it, and another minute to ease their way up through the main basement to the gimmicked back door. The streets in this part of Drev Starn were mostly deserted at this hour. The high-mounted glow panels dimmed to a fairly low light.
I'll take back here,
Navit murmured to Cliff.
You circle around front. Don't let anyone see you. Don't worry.
Moving like a shadow, Cliff headed down the side alley and disappeared around the corner of the building. Checking both directions, Navit crossed to a trash container a few meters away. Sinking into his shadow, he balanced his blaster across one knee and waited. And waited. Occasionally, he spotted figures hurrying by in front of the lighted windows of the tapcaf, and several times the Ho-Din or one of his night guards poked their head out the back door, double-checked the lock, and went back in. But no one came out and stayed out. Not the woman or anyone else. It was an hour before the commotion seemed to finally die down inside. Navit waited another 30 minutes, irritably counting the number of shovelfuls behind schedule this was costing them,
before finally pulling out his comlink.
Cliff?
Nothing.
Cliff's voice came back. He sounded irritated, too.
Sounds like they've given up.
Must have been a false alarm, Navid said. Come on around and we'll get back to work.
A few minutes later, they were back in the sub-basement. Cliff retrieved the drop cloth as Navid headed around the stacked Votocreen cases for the disintegrator, and paused there. Lying on top of the disintegrator was a comm link.
Cliff,
he called softly.
Come here.
A moment later, the other was at his side.
I don't believe it, he said, sounding stunned. How in blazes did she pull this one off?
Why don't we ask her?
Navid said, carefully picking up the comlink. It was a binary linked type, he noted. The sort typically carried on small starships and connected only to another specific comlink. He gave it a quick once-over for booby traps, then flicked it on.
You're very inventive, he said. I'll give you that.
Why, thank you.
The old woman's voice came back promptly.
That's very flattering, particularly coming from an Imperial Dirty Tricks team.
Navid glanced at Cliff.
You know, that's the second time you've accused us of being Imperials, he reminded her. You are just guessing, of course.
Oh, hardly. Who else would be looking to take down the Bothans' planetary shields?
You're still just guessing, Navid said, straining his ears for some sign of telltale sounds in the background, and wishing viciously he had the equipment that would let him trace the transmission. If you were sure, you'd have called Bothan Security instead of still skulking around yourself this way.
Who says I haven't called them? Or maybe I like skulking around. It could be I used to do this sort of thing all the time against Hutts and other slime. Maybe I'm looking for a new challenge.
Or maybe you're looking for an early and violent death, Navid countered. How did you find us, anyway?
Oh, come on. You don't really think your cover is that good, do you? My new rep buddies and I had you pegged first time off the rack. So what was the deal with those metal mites at the shield generator, anyway?
Navid smiled tightly.
Fishing now, are we? Please.
You can never tell. Incidentally, whichever of you gimmicked that back door lock needs to do a better job next time. It was so obvious, you might as well have hung a sign on it. It did come in handy, though.
I imagine it did, Navid said. You're still in the building, aren't you?
Now who's fishing? Actually, no. I left some time ago. There's a crawl space beneath the ceiling that leads to a handy skylight. That was a free one.
Thank you,
Navid said between clenched teeth. Who did this little fringe slime think she was talking to anyway?
Here's some free advice in return. Go back to your ship and clear off Bothui. If you don't, you are going to die on this dirt ball. I will personally guarantee that.
With all due respect, Lieutenant, or is it Major? Colonel? Oh, well, with the Empire in shambles these days, I guess rank doesn't really matter. With all due respect, Imperial, I've been threatened by far more impressive folks than you. Any time you want to come out and do a face-to-face, I'm ready.
Oh, we'll do a face-to-face, all right,
Navid promised, forcing down his anger. Anger and the muddled thinking that accompanied it were exactly what she was angling for.
Don't worry about that. But when we do, it will be a time and place of my choosing, not yours.
Whatever you want. Nighttime would work best. That way you can use that zero-all-night stinger of yours to full advantage. You didn't just throw it away after that riot a few weeks back, did you? The one where you framed Solo for shooting into the crowd?
Navid glared at the comlink. Aside from being a general all-around pain in the neck, this woman was far too well-informed. Who in space did she work for, anyway? You're fishing again, he said.
Not really,
she said offhandedly.
Just putting two and two together.
Sometimes that kind of math doesn't work the way you think it does,
Navid warned her.
And sometimes, if the mathematician hangs around where she's not welcome, she doesn't live to finish her sums.
She clucked.
You're starting to repeat yourself, Imperial. If I were you, I'd try to work up some fresh threats. However, it's well past my bedtime, and I know you have work to do. So I'll let you go. Unless you'd like to go fetch your Zerol and come out and play, that is. I'll wait.
Thanks, Navid said. I'll pass for now.
Entirely up to you. Go ahead and keep the comlink. I've got plenty of spares. Good night. And happy digging.
The transmission clicked off. And restless and unpleasant dreams to you too, Navid murmured, dropping the comlink into the disintegrator. He looked back at Cliff.
This, he said darkly, is just exactly what we needed.
Oh, exactly, Cliff ground out. So what are we going to do about it?
For now, nothing,
Navid said, picking up the disintegrator and lugging it over to the drop cloth.
For all her fishing and accusations, she doesn't really know anything.
Like blazes she doesn't, Cliff retorted. She knows we're digging over one of the shield building's power conduits. What more does she need?
My point exactly, Navid said. She spotted our digging, but hasn't called security down on us.
He squatted down and eased his shovel blade under the edge of their trapdoor.
Why not?
How should I know?
Cliff grumbled, getting his shovel into place under the other side.
Maybe she figures she'll pick up a bounty if she can deliver everything in a neat package.
Could be,
Navid said, lifting carefully. The block came up, and he got his fingers under the edge.
I think it's more likely she's got some trouble of her own with the Bothans. That means she can't go to them with any accusations.
That wouldn't stop her from calling in an anonymous tip,
Cliff grunted, as they eased the trap door off the hole.
The mood they're in out there, they're probably jumping at every cracked twig.
No,
Navid said, gazing into the hole.
No, she's not the type for anonymous tips. I think that for whatever reason, she's decided to take this whole thing personally. Professional pride, maybe, I don't know. The point is that she's turned this into a private duel between her and us.
Cliff grunted.
Pretty stupid.
Stupid for her, Navid agreed. Useful for us.
Maybe, Cliff said. So what now?
We get back to work,
Navid said, dropping into the hole.
And when we're done, he added,
digging his shovel into the packed dirt at his feet.
I'll go retrieve the Zerol. Maybe tomorrow night we'll take her up on her invitation to come out and play.
Gaversim looked up from Leia's datapad, his prehensile wingtips flicking relentlessly across the desk beside it.
Oh, and you truly believe he is sincere about this?
He said.
Very sincere,
Leia said, feeling a frown creasing her forehead. She had expected a considerably more positive reaction to Pellion's peace proposal.
And I examined the credentials he brought from the Imperial Moffs. Everything was in order.
Or so it appeared,
Gaversim said, shaking his mane.
Oh, So it appeared.
He looked back down at the datapad, touched the control to scroll back. Leia watched him, trying to understand this strange and unexpected emotional conflict she could sense in him. An end to the long war might finally be at hand. Surely this was news for at least cautious excitement. So why wasn't he cautiously excited? Gaversum looked up at her again.
There's no mention of Thrawn anywhere in here, he pointed out. Did you ask Pelion about that?
We discussed it briefly, Leia said. At that time, he'd received no word from Bastion that Thrawn had assumed supreme command. Nor had he had any indication that the Moffs had rescinded his authorization to begin peace talks.
No, neither of which means anything at all, Gaversum said,
his tone suddenly and uncharacteristically harsh.
With Thrawn on the scene, officially or otherwise, this is utterly meaningless. No!
He slapped a wingtip across the datapad.
I understand your concerns, Leia said, choosing her words carefully. But if it's not a trick, this may be our chance to finally end this long war.
It is most certainly a trick, Counselor,
Gaversum ground out.
That much we can all be sure of. The only question is what exactly Thrawn hopes to gain from it.
Leia drew back in her seat, the flash of emotion right then.
You don't want Pelion's offer to be genuine, do you?
She asked.
You want it to be a trick.
Gaversum turned his eyes away from her, snorting a soft, whinnying sigh.
Oh, look all around us, Leia, he said quietly,
turning his head to gaze out the stateroom viewport.
Look at them. Nearly 200 warships, dozens of peoples, all ready to begin a civil war over their own individual concepts of what constitutes justice for Kar-Mas. The New Republic is poised ready to destroy itself. Ooh! And there's nothing I can do to prevent it.
Han has a copy of the Kar-Mas document, Leia reminded him. He'll have it here tomorrow. That should diffuse a lot of the tension.
I'm sure it will, Gaversum agreed. But at this point, I'm not willing to rely on even that to stop them. You and I both know that for many of the potential combatants, Kar-Mas has merely become a convenient excuse for restarting old wars with old enemies.
I realize that, Leia said. But once that excuse is taken away from them, they'll have to back down.
Or create a different excuse,
Gaversum countered bitterly.
Oh, the fact is, Leia, that the New Republic is in danger of fragmenting, of being driven apart by our own vast diversity. We need time to counter those forces. Time to talk. Time to plan. Time to try and to build all these different peoples into some sort of unity. Oh!
He waved a wing toward the viewport.
But we no longer have that time. This crisis has snatched it away from us. We need to get it back.
The Kar-Mas document will do that, Leia insisted. I'm sure it will.
Perhaps, Gaversum said. But as president, I can't afford to put all my hopes on it. I must prepare to muster every common purpose I can find for the New Republic. Every common purpose, every common goal, every common cultural ethos.
He tapped the datapad, gently this time.
Oh! And if necessary, every common enemy.
But there's not a real enemy anymore, Leia said, striving to keep her voice calm. They're far too small and weak to be any kind of threat.
Perhaps, Gaversum said. But as long as they're out there, we have someone to unite against.
He hesitated.
Or even to fight against, if necessary.
You aren't serious, Leia said, gazing hard at him. Stirring up action against the Empire at this point would be nothing short of a slaughter.
I know that,
he shook his head.
I don't like this any better than you do, Leia. In fact, I will admit to being ashamed of using the people of the Empire this way. But whether my name and memory are denounced by history is of no importance. My job is to hold the New Republic together, and I will do whatever is necessary to achieve that.
Perhaps I have more faith in our people than you do, Leia said quietly.
Oh, perhaps you do,
Gabrielsen said with a nod.
I sincerely hope you are right.
Oh. For a moment they sat together in silence. I presume you won't be releasing news of Pelion's offer,
Leia said at last.
With your permission, though, I'd like to begin putting together a list of delegates for a full peace conference, if and when you decide to proceed with this.
Gabrielsen hesitated, then nodded.
I admire your confidence, Counselor, he said. I only wish I could share it. Yes, please assemble your list.
Thank you.
She got up from her chair and retrieved her datapad.
I'll have the list ready for you by tomorrow.
She turned to the stateroom door.
Oh, there is, of course, one other option open to you,
Gabrielsen called from behind her.
You are merely on leave of absence from the presidency. Assuming the Senate confirmed the decision, you could resume that office right now.
I know, Leia said. But this isn't the time for that. Yours is the voice that has been speaking for Coruscant since the Ka'amas document first came to light. It wouldn't be good for that voice to suddenly change.
Perhaps,
Gabrielsen said.
But there are many in the New Republic who believe that Calibops are skilled at words and nothing more. Perhaps the time for words has ended, and the time for action has arrived. Oh!
Leia stretched out briefly to the Force.
The time for action may indeed have come, she agreed. But that doesn't mean the time for words is ended. Both will always be needed.
Gabrielsen whinnied softly.
Oh! Then I will continue with the words, he said. And will entrust to you the actions. May the Force be with us both.
May the Force be with us all,
Leia said quietly.
Good night, President Gabrielsen.
Chapter 33.
She waited until an hour after the background sounds of the household had quieted down. Then, getting up from her bed, Shada left her room in the vast underground complex that was Georges Cardass's home and slipped down the darkened hallway. The library door was closed, and the Ang-Ti hand-waving trick Cardass had used to get inside obviously wasn't going to work for her. However, before saying goodnight, he had showed her and Card the more conventional method of opening their room doors, and she was banking on the library being set up the same way. Searching around the stones lining the doorway with her fingers, she found the slightly cooler one and pressed her palm against it. For perhaps 20 seconds, nothing happened. Shada maintained her pressure on the stone, alert for signs of activity in the area, and wondering again at this ridiculous procedure. Based on the life story he told them, she couldn't see the Georges Cardass who had first arrived here on Exicron being an overly patient man. Certainly not the type to install doors in his home that took half a minute to open. She could only assume his thinking at the time had been that intruders bent on theft or violence would be similarly impatient. Now, of course, with his Ang-Ti tricks, none of it mattered. At least not to him.
beneath her hand, the trigger stone gave a gentle bump. Shada held on, and a few seconds later, the door finally slid ponderously open. She'd expected the library to be as dark as the rest of the house, with only a handful of muted glow panels to show the way around. To her uneasy surprise, the room was lit much more brightly than that. Not as bright as it had been when Kardash showed it to them earlier, but brighter than an uninhabited room ought to be. She slipped inside, ducking to the left out of the doorway. And as she did so, she caught a glimpse of a moving shadow in the central circle near the computer desk. Kardash? She bit back a curse. Card had already scheduled an early morning departure for the Wild Card's rendezvous with the Yang-T ship. This was her one and only chance to get the data card she needed to find. And then, drifting up from the computer desk, she heard a muffled but very familiar voice. Distinctive, somewhat prissy, and quite mechanical. Silently, she detached herself from the wall and made her way down one of the narrow aisles between the data cases and headed to the center, to find that her ears had indeed not been playing tricks on her.
"Hello, Mistress Shada,"
3PO said brightly, straightening up from his stooping lean over the computer desk.
"I thought you and the others had retired for the night."
"I thought you had done so too," Shada said, glancing at the nearest data case as she stepped over to him. Each shelf completely packed with stacks of data cards, each stack of data cards standing 8 to 10 deep. An incredible collection of knowledge.
"Or whatever it is droids do at night."
"Oh, I usually close down for a time. But during my talk earlier with Master Kardash, he suggested I might wish to have a chat with his main computer. Not that the computer aboard the Wild Card is in decent company, of course. But I must admit, I sometimes miss R2 and others of my own kind."
"I understand," Shada assured him, a lump forming in her throat.
"It can be very lonely to be somewhere where you're out of place."
"Really?"
3PO said interestedly.
"I suppose I've always assumed human beings were adaptable to most every place and circumstance."
"Being adaptable to something doesn't necessarily mean you like it," Shada pointed out. "In many ways, I'm as much out of place aboard the Wild Card as you are."
The droid tilted his head.
"I'm so sorry, Mistress Shada,"
he said, sounding pained.
"I had no idea you felt that way. Is there anything I can do to help?"
"Maybe help me return to where I belong."
Shada gestured down at the computer desk.
"Have you gotten to know the computer well enough to be able to do a search of Kardash's library?"
"Certainly,"
3PO said, his voice suddenly wary.
"But this is Master Kardash's equipment. I'm not sure I should..."
"It'll be all right," Shada soothed him. "I'm not going to steal anything. All I want is one small piece of information."
"I suppose that would be all right,"
3PO said, still sounding uncertain.
"We are his guests, after all, and guests often have the tacit run of the household. I..."
He stopped as Shada held up a hand.
"Can you do the search?"
she asked again.
"Yes, Mistress Shada,"
he replied in a somewhat subdued voice.
"What is it you wish to search for?"
Shada took a deep breath.
"Emboline,"
a quiet voice came from behind her.
"The planet Emboline."
"Oh my!"
3PO gasped. Shada spun around, dropping into a slight crouch, her hand diving beneath her tunic to the grip of her blaster.
"Forgive me,"
Kardash said, coming into view around the inner circle of data cases.
"I didn't mean to startle you that way."
"I certainly hope not,"
Shada said, her grip still on her blaster, muscles and reflexes preparing for combat. If Kardash took exception to her being here...
"I didn't hear you come in."
"I didn't mean for you to hear me,"
he said, smiling.
"You're not planning to use that blaster, are you?"
So much for Mistral subtlety.
"No, of course not,"
she said, withdrawing her hand empty.
"I was just..."
She broke off, frowning, as the words he had spoken a moment earlier suddenly penetrated her conscious mind.
What did you say when you came in?
I told 3PO you wanted to do a search for the planet Imbolane,
Cardass said, eyeing her steadily.
That is what you were gonna look up, wasn't it? My young Mistral Shadow Guard?
Her first impulse was to deny it, but looking into that even gaze, she knew it would be a waste of effort.
How long have you known?
She asked instead.
Oh, not long at all,
he said, waving a hand in an oddly self-deprecating gesture.
I suspected, of course, but I didn't actually know until you defeated those swore swoopers outside Bombasa's place.
Shada grimaced. So Card was right, she said. He thought giving Bombasa his name would eventually get it back to you.
Cardass shook his head.
You misunderstand. Bombasa doesn't work for me, nor I for him. In fact, aside from Entun Ni and the other few in my household, no one actually works for me at all.
Right. You're retired,
Shada growled.
I forgot.
Or else you don't truly believe,
Cardass countered.
Tell me, what is it you want for Imbolane?
What everyone else wants,
she shot back.
At least what they want for big, important worlds like Ka'amas. I want justice for my people.
Cardass shook his head.
Your people don't want justice, Shayla,
he said, an infinite sadness in his voice.
They never did.
What are you talking about?
Shada demanded, feeling her face warming.
How dare you judge us? How dare you judge anyone? Sitting out here all high and mighty, never deigning to get your own hands dirty while everyone else fights and bleeds and dies?
She broke off, her rising fury at his attitude battling against her deeply ingrained fear of losing control.
You don't know what it's like on Imbolane,
she bit out.
You've never seen the suffering and squalor. You have no business saying we've given up.
Cardass's eyebrows lifted.
I never said you'd given up,
he corrected her gently.
What I said was that you didn't want justice.
Then what do we want?
Shada snarled.
Charity? Pity?
No.
Cardass shook his head.
Vengeance.
Shada felt her eyes narrow.
What are you talking about?
Do you know why Imbolane died, Shada?
Cardass asked.
Not how it died. Not the firestorming and massive air and space attack that finally crushed it. But why?
She stared at him, a dark uneasiness beginning to swirl into the flame of her anger and frustration. There was something behind his eyes that she didn't like the look of at all.
Someone feared our growing power and prestige, and decided to make an example of us,
she said carefully.
Something that person was Palpatine himself, which is why we've never worked for his empire.
The eyebrows lifted again.
Never?
Shada had to look away from that gaze.
We had millions of refugees to feed and clothe,
she said, her voice sounding hollowly defensive in her ears.
Yes, sometimes we worked even for the Empire.
For a moment, the room was filled with an awkward silence.
Principles are so often like that, aren't they?
Cardass said at last.
So very slippery. So hard to hold on to.
Shada looked back at him again, trying to come up with a properly scathing retort. But nothing came to mind. In Imbolane's case, in the Mistral's case, his quiet cynicism was all too true.
At any rate, that particular principle was of no real value,
Cardass continued.
As it happens, Palpatine had nothing to do with Imbolane's destruction.
He stepped past her and around to the data case behind 3PO.
I have the true history of your world right here,
he said, waving at the top row of data cards.
I pulled all the information together once I knew you'd be coming here with Card. Would you like to see it?
Automatically, Shada stepped toward him, hesitated.
What do you mean by true? She asked. What does anyone mean by true? We both know history is written by the winners.
History is also written by the bystanders,
Cardass said, his hand still up beside the data cards.
By the Kamasi, and the Alderanians, and the Jedi. People who had no part or stake in what happened. Would you accuse all of them of lying?
Shada swallowed, fear and a horrible sense of inevitability twisting itself around her throat.
And what do all these disinterested parties say?
She asked. Slowly, Cardass lowered his hand.
They say that 3 years before its destruction,
he said gently,
the rulers of Imbaline set off on a rampage of conquest. And for the first 2.5 of those years, they destroyed and conquered and plundered every one of the dozen other worlds within their reach.
No,
Shada heard herself whisper.
No, that can't be true. We wouldn't. We couldn't have done something like that.
The average citizens weren't told the true story, of course,
Cardass said.
Though I imagine most could have read between the lines if they truly wanted to know what their leaders were doing. But they had triumph and spoils, pride and glory. Why bother with mere truth?
Again, Shada had to look away from those eyes.
It wasn't my fault, she wanted to protest. I wasn't there. I didn't do it.
But the words were hollow, and she knew it. No, she hadn't been one of those who had toasted Emberlyn's conquests and looked eagerly ahead for more. But in dedicating her life to the Mistral, she had in her own way helped to perpetuate the lie. All because she had wanted to make a difference.
You shouldn't take any of this personally, Shada,
Cardass offered softly into her thoughts.
You didn't know. And the desire to make a difference is something held deeply within all of us.
Shada looked sharply at him.
Stay out of my mind, she snapped. My thoughts are none of your business.
He bowed his head briefly.
I'm sorry,
he said.
I didn't mean to intrude. But when someone is shouting, it's usually difficult not to overhear.
Well, try harder.
Shada took a deep breath.
So what happened? How were we finally stopped?
Your victims and potential victims were too weak to fight back on their own,
Cardass said.
So they pooled their resources and hired a mercenary army. The army was, perhaps, overly thorough.
Overly thorough. Again, Shada searched for a blistering retort. Again, there was nothing she could say.
And all in the sector rejoiced,
she murmured.
Yes,
Cardass said quietly.
But for the stopping of a dangerous war machine, not for the suffering of the innocent.
No. The innocent are never a very high priority, are they?
Shada said, hearing the bitterness in her voice.
Does your true history tell who the army was who destroyed us? Or who their sponsors were?
His face seemed to settle subtly.
Why do you want to know?
Shada shrugged, an uncomfortable hunching of suddenly tired shoulders.
My people have never known who did it.
And if I give you that information, what will you do with it?
Cardass asked.
Turn the vengeance of the Mistral against them after all these years? Create more suffering among still more innocents?
The words were a sudden stab in her heart.
I don't know what they'll do with it,
Shada said, a sudden misting in her eyes blurring her sight.
All I know is that it's the only thing I can take back that might let...
She broke off, swiping viciously at her eyes.
You don't want to go back to them, Shada,
Cardass said.
They're living a lie. Whether they know it or not, that's not for you.
I have to,
Shada said miserably.
Don't you understand? I have to work for something larger than myself. I've always needed that. I have to have something to hold on to and serve that I can believe in.
What about the New Republic?
Cardass asked.
Or Card himself?
The New Republic doesn't want me,
she bit out.
And Card...
She shook her head, an acid burning in her throat.
Card's a smuggler, Cardass, just like you were. What kind of purpose is that to believe in?
Oh, I don't know,
Cardass said thoughtfully.
Card has altered the organization considerably since my days with it.
It's still the fringe, Shada said. It's still illegal and underhanded. I want something honorable, something noble. Is that so much to ask for?
No, of course not,
Cardass said.
Still, Card's much more an information broker now than he is a smuggler. Isn't that at least a little better?
No, Shada said. In fact, it's worse. Information brokering is nothing more than selling people's private property to those who don't deserve to have it.
Interesting point of view,
Cardass murmured, his gaze shifting to Shada's right.
Have you ever considered it that way?
I haven't up until now, Card's voice said. Shada spun around, shaking the last lingering tears from her eyes. Off to her right, dressed in a robe and ship slippers, Card was standing just outside the inner circle, regarding her with an odd expression on his face.
Perhaps I need to reassess my thinking, he added.
What are you doing here?
Shada demanded.
Cardass called me, Card said.
He looked at Cardass, his forehead wrinkling.
At least, I think he called me.
Oh yes, definitely,
Cardass assured him.
I thought you should be in on this part of the conversation.
He bowed his head to Shada.
Forgive me again, Shada, if I startled you.
Shada fought back a grimace.
He's just full of surprises, isn't he?
He commented.
He's always been that way,
Card agreed, stepping over to her side.
All right, Cardass. Your two puppets are assembled and awaiting your commands. What do you want from us?
Cardass's eyes widened in a look of innocence.
Me?
He protested.
I want nothing from you, my friends. On the contrary, I wish to present you with a gift.
Shada glanced at Card, found him throwing her the same suspicious look.
Really? Card said dryly. And what kind of gift might that be?
Cardass smiled.
You never were one to appreciate surprises, were you, Card?
He said.
Not too bad at dealing them out, mind you, but extremely poor at accepting them. But I think you'll like this one.
He turned to the data case behind him and selected two data cards from the top shelf.
This is the gift I offer,
he said, turning back to face them, holding one of the data cards in each hand.
This,
he held up his right hand,
is the history of Emberlyne I was just speaking to Shada about. Something she very much wants, or at least has thought in the past that she wanted. This,
he held up his left hand,
is a data card I made up especially for you. One which I personally think will be far more beneficial for everyone in the long run.
What's on it?
Card asked.
Useful information.
Cardass laid them down side by side on the computer desk.
You may have one of them. Please, choose.
Beside her, Shada felt Card take a deep breath.
It's your choice, Shada, he said quietly. Take whichever one you wish.
was the antithesis of what she herself had always yearned for. But to her weary surprise, the turmoil never came. Had Cardass's earlier revelations merely burned all of it out of her, she wondered vaguely, leaving no strength left to drive such emotions as anger or uncertainty? But no, there was no turmoil because there was no real decision to be made. Cardass was right. She could no longer work with the Mistral, who served and killed and died so that Emberlyn could someday rise again. Not now that she knew what Emberlyn had once been. And certainly not now that she could see what the Eleven might do with the knowledge on that data card. The justice she had once thought she was seeking had already been carried out. All that data card could create was vengeance. Reaching across the desk, distantly aware that she was now finally crossing the final bridge from her past, she picked up the data card on the right.
I'm pleased with you, Shader Dukal, child of the Mistral,
Cardass said with a warmth she had never heard in his voice before.
I promise you won't be disappointed.
Shada looked at Card, steeling herself for his reaction to Cardass's revelation, but he merely smiled.
It's all right, he said. I've known who you are for a long time.
She looked back at Cardass.
Who I was, she corrected Card quietly. What I am now, I don't know.
You'll find your way,
Cardass assured her. Abruptly, he straightened and rubbed his hands together.
But now, it's time to go.
Shada blinked.
Already? I thought we had until morning.
Why, it is morning out there,
Cardass said, coming around the computer desk and taking Card and Shada each by an arm.
Close enough, at least. Come, come! There's a great deal yet for you to do. You too, 3PO. Come along.
What about this?
Shada asked, waving the data card as Cardass hustled them up the aisle toward the exit.
You can read it on the way to the rendezvous point,
Cardass told her.
Just the two of you, together. No one else. After that, I think you'll know what to do.
They reached the door, and Cardass waved it open.
What about you?
Card asked as the old man steered them back down the hallway, now properly lit again, toward their rooms.
My door's always open to you,
Cardass said.
Either of you, of course. Come back any time you want to visit. But for now, you must hurry.
An hour later, the wild card lifted from Exocron and headed out into space. An hour after that, after assuring himself they were properly on their way to their rendezvous with the waiting Ang-T ship, Card took Shada back to his office. And sitting together in front of his desk display, they read the data card. Shada was the first to break the silence.
He was right, wasn't he?
She murmured.
This is incredible. If it's true, that is.
Oh, it's true,
Card said, gazing at the display, his mind spinning furiously. Shada had vastly understated the case. Incredible didn't even begin to cover it. If he was nothing else in his entire life, Cardass was always reliable.
I can believe that.
Shada shook her head.
I take it we're going to have the Ang-T take us straight back to Coruscant with this?
Card hesitated. Coruscant was, of course, the obvious choice, but there was a complete range of possibilities here. Some very interesting possibilities indeed.
Card?
Shada cut into his thoughts, her tone suddenly suspicious.
We are taking this back to Coruscant, aren't we?
He smiled at her.
Actually, no, he said. I think we can do better than that.
He looked back at the display, feeling his smile turn grim.
Much, much better.
Standing astride the command walkway of the Imperial Star Destroyer Tyrannic, Captain Nalgal stared out into the blackness beyond the viewports.
There was still nothing to see out there, of course, unless one of their probe ships happened to dip into the edge of the cloaking shield, or he wanted to contemplate the dirty edge of the comet at their side. But it was tradition for a ship's captain to gaze at the universe from his bridge, and Nalgal was feeling rather traditional today. 4 days. 4 more days, and the long, stultifying idleness would finally be over. Just 4 days. Assuming the strike team was still on schedule. 4 days. From the far end of the command walkway, he could hear Intelligence Chief Oysen's slightly clunky footsteps approaching. Nearly 10 minutes late, he noted with disapproval as he glanced at his chrono.
Captain?
Oysen said, puffing slightly as he came up beside Nalgal.
I have the latest probe ship report for you.
Nalgal turned to him, noting the slight redness of Oysen's face.
You're late, he said.
There was more analysis required than usual,
Oysen said stiffly, holding out a data pad.
It seems the ships over Bothawi nearly started the war a few days early.
Nalgal felt his eyes narrow as he took the data pad.
What are you talking about?
He demanded, keying for the proper file.
One of the Ishori warships decided to push at the Diamala,
Oysen said.
He came within half a blink of pushing them into open combat.
Nalgal swore under his breath, glancing over the report. If those hot-headed alien fools started their hostilities before the strike team was ready...
What stopped them?
He asked.
Never mind. There it is,
he added, skimming the section.
Interesting. Did anyone get an ID on that freighter?
None of the probe ships were close enough for a positive ID,
Oysen said.
But the follow-up comm traffic through the fleet said it was High Counselor Organa Solo. That's unconfirmed, though.
But highly likely,
Nalgal grunted.
Here to help Gavrisim calm everyone down, no doubt.
No doubt.
Oysen lifted his eyebrows.
The rumors also say she brought a car Marcy Trustant with her.
Do they now?
Nalgal said, feeling a slow smile starting to tug at the corners of his mouth.
Do they really?
We shall know for sure in a day or two,
Oysen pointed out.
If Gavrisim has a real Karmasi there with his peace envoy, he's sure to parade him out in front of everybody as soon as he can.
Indeed,
Nalgal murmured.
And if we can keep him here talking peace for 4 more days, we'll be able to say there was a Karmasi present at the destruction of Bothawi. Present, and by implication, fully approving.
He shook his head wonderingly.
Amazing. I wonder how Thrawn pulled that one off.
It's amazing, all right,
Oysen agreed, not sounding nearly so enthusiastic.
I just hope he hasn't miscalculated somewhere along the line. 191 warships would be a little much for 3 Star Destroyers to take on all by ourselves.
You worry too much,
Nalgal chided, handing back the data pad.
I've seen Thrawn at work, and he never miscalculates anything. The strike team will do their job, and then those warships of yours will commence tearing each other apart. All we'll have to do is eliminate the survivors and demolish whatever's left of the planet.
Or so goes the theory, anyway,
Oysen said sourly.
May I recommend, Captain, that you at least put the Tyrannic and the others on standby alert for the remainder of our time out here? That way we'll be able to move quickly if things break sooner than expected.
It'll also mean 4 extra days worth of worn-off combat edges,
Nalgal reminded him.
I hardly think that will be useful.
But if things break too soon...
They won't!
Nalgal cut him off brusquely.
If Thrawn says 4 days, it'll be 4 days, period.
Oysen took a deep breath.
Yes, sir,
he muttered. Nalgal eyed the other, a mixture of contempt and pity flickering through him. Oisin, after all, had never met Thrawn, had never heard the confidence and authority in the Grand Admiral's voice. How could he possibly understand?
All right, we'll compromise, he said. I'll order preliminary battle prep to begin this afternoon, and one day before the projected flashpoint, we'll go to standby alert. Will that make you feel better?
Yes, sir.
Oisin's mouth twitched.
Thank you, sir.
And your preliminary battle prep will begin right now,
Nalgal continued, gesturing at the data pad.
I want you to make up a priority threat list for every one of those ships out there. Put in everything you have about their capabilities, defenses, and weaknesses, and include details of captain and crew species where possible.
He smiled tightly.
When we finally come from under this cursed cloaking shield, I want to be able to slice straight through whatever's left without losing so much as a single turbo laser or prey bird. Understood?
Understood, Captain,
Oisin said.
I'll have it ready for you by tomorrow.
Very good,
Nalgal nodded.
Dismissed.
Turning smartly, Oisin headed aft at a quick walk along the command walkway. Nalgal watched him for a moment, then turned back to the empty view through the viewport. 4 days. 4 days, and they would finally have their chance to slaughter rebel scum. He smiled into the darkness. Yes, he was indeed feeling very traditional today. Chapter 34. With a start, Luke woke up. For a moment, he stayed where he was, fighting against the usual floundering of trance-induced disorientation as he made a quick assessment of his situation. He was seated in a slightly uncomfortable seat, he recognized, with an unfamiliar control board in front of him and a curved canopy in front of that. From somewhere behind him, a handful of soft nightlights glowed. In front of him, outside the canopy, it was completely dark outside. He blinked, coming suddenly fully awake. Completely dark outside. He fumbled with his restraints, throwing a glance at his chrono as he did so, and paused, giving the chrono a second look. He'd been in a healing trance for nearly 5 hours. 5 hours? Mara, I said to wake me in 2 hours. He called back toward the rear of the ship, getting free of the restraints and stumbling to his feet. What happened? You fall asleep back there yourself? But there was no answer. Only the sudden frantic twittering from R2. And there was also no Mara. Oh no, Luke breathed, stretching his mind out to flick through every corner of the ship. Mara was nowhere to be found. R2, where is she? He snapped, dropping to one knee and lifting up the datapad translator still hooked up to the droid. The words scrolled across it. What do you mean she left? He demanded. When? Why? R2 moaned mournfully. Luke gazed at the words flowing across the datapad, his heart sinking inside him. Mara had left 5 hours ago, right after he'd settled into his trance. R2 didn't know where she'd gone or why. But both of those Luke could already guess. It's all right, he sighed, patting the droid reassuringly as he got back to his feet. I know there's no way you could have stopped her. He crossed to the hatch, the taste of terrible fear mixing with the bitter knowledge that whatever she had gone off to do, it was far too late now for him to stop her either. Keep an eye on the ship, he told the little droid, popping open the hatch. I'll be back as soon as I can. He stepped outside, not bothering with the ladder, but simply dropping to the ground. Directly overhead, between the surrounding cliff peaks, patches of stars shone brightly down through the gaps between drifting clouds. Everywhere else, all was darkness. Mara! He called out, shouting her name hopelessly into the silent night with his mind. It was as if a cloaked and hooded figure had stirred. Somewhere not far away, a
a dark hiding presence seemed to shift. A crack opened between cloak and hood.
Up here,
her thought came back. Luke peered up at the blackness of the cliff directly ahead. Caught between the sudden relief that she was still alive and the sobering sense that something terrible was still about to happen. The glimpse faded as Mara seemed to pull her mental cloak back around her.
Where are you?
Luke sent the thought outward, fighting back the temptation to break through this cocoon she had suddenly and inexplicably retreated into. He sensed her hesitation and her almost resigned sigh. Then, flashing into his mind like glimpses seen in a flickering light, he caught a series of images of the rock face in front of him, marking the route she'd taken up. Sending an acknowledgement and encouragement back toward her, he crossed to the cliff and started up. The climb wasn't nearly as tricky as he had thought it would be, and with Jedi strength and muscles behind it, the trip took less than 10 minutes. He found Mara sitting on a rough ledge near the peak, braced sideways against the particular shelter of a rugged upthrust of rock.
Hello,
she called quietly as he came up onto the final ridge.
How are you feeling?
Completely healed, he said, frowning at her as he maneuvered his way along the ridge and sat down beside her.
Her voice had been quiet and controlled, but beneath the dark cloak of her mental barrier, he could sense the edge of an incredible sadness.
What's going on?
In the faint sheen of starlight, he saw her right hand lift and point ahead.
The hand of Thrawn's over there,
she said.
You can see the four back towers against the clouds when the light's right.
Luke gazed that direction, running through his sensory enhancement techniques. The towers and back wall of the fortress were indeed visible, along with a hint of something between the leftmost towers that was probably the flat roof of the hangar they'd fought their way out of a few hours ago.
What have they been doing?
He asked.
Nothing much,
Mara said.
That ship that was out? Remember the gap we saw in the parking array? It got in about 3 hours ago.
Luke grimaced. A functional ship, sitting right there in front of the ones he'd sabotaged? Ready to head off to Bastion at a moment's notice.
It hasn't left again?
He sensed the shake of her head.
Not that I could tell. Anyway, Park said they'd be debriefing the pilot before he made a final decision.
I see, Luke murmured.
A debriefing that, under the circumstances, Park and Fell would undoubtedly be hurrying along as quickly as they could. A fast decision, a fast lift back into the sky, and the Empire would have the hand of Thrawn and all its secrets.
And yet, here he and Mara sat,
waiting.
But for what? It's funny, you know,
Mara murmured from beside him.
Ironic, really. Here we are.